The headlines. Iran says it is the United States that should take the first step in return to its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal before Tehran complies with it. The UN says thousands of Yemeni civilians are at risk in the western province of Hodeidah amid an increase in fighting there. And tens of thousands of registered members of the U.S. Republican Party have shifted their affiliation in the weeks after supporters of Donald Trump attacked Capitol. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian foreign minister says it is the U.S. that should return to its obligations under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal first. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said that Washington violated the nuclear agreement, prevented supplies of food and medicines to Iran, and punished countries which abided by the U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231. On the other hand, he added that Iran complied with the nuclear deal. Zarif's reaction came after the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that Washington will return to the agreement only when Tehran goes back to full compliance with the accord. The former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran. In return, Iran scaled back its commitments under the deal, citing the remaining signatories' failure to uphold their end of the bargain. Political commentator John Stepling believes that the new U.S. President Joe Biden has been a warmonger and is not going to turn into a pacifist.
He's a chief warmonger for the U.S. government. He is not going to turn into a pacifist and a logical statesman who cares about the well-being of people in the world. I mean, he's just never done that. And his other appointment, of course, and he's always been intimate with the defense industry. He has long-standing ties with the defense industry. So we're not going to see a decrease in U.S. military interventions. We're going to see a serious uptick. Trump talked about taking the troops out of Afghanistan, taking the troops back out of Syria, all of these things. Biden's already said he's not going to do that. These should be pretty obvious clues as to what Biden's going to do. So, whether he gets back to the JCPOA or not almost doesn't matter because the long-term designs are clear, and he sees the U.S. as the global cop, and he intends to use the military far more than Trump did and probably even more than Obama did.
The UN says thousands of Yemeni civilians are at risk in the western province of Hodeidah amid an increase in fighting. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs called on the parties involved in the conflict to take all necessary measures to protect civilian lives. The UN agency stressed that indiscriminate attacks on residential areas constitute a breach of international humanitarian law and must stop immediately. At least 8 civilians, mostly women and children, were killed last week during clashes in Hodeidah. Some 700 people have also been displaced in the recent fighting between Ansarullah and Saudi-backed militants. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war in Yemen in March 2015, which has so far killed tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians and displaced many more. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says its huge budget shortfall could lead to a financial collapse of the agency, even if the U.S. resumes funding the group. The UN agency says the 2021 financial year looks very difficult, as its annual deficit is expected to hit $200 million. Moreover, the agency has liabilities of $75 million from the previous year. UNRWA says that U.S. re-engagement could slightly improve income, but it will not cover the agency's huge liabilities. The U.S. halted its support for the UN agency under former President Donald Trump. More than 30,000 registered voters of the U.S. Republican Party switched sides weeks after supporters of former President Donald Trump attacked Capitol Hill. The unprecedented wave of defections spells trouble for a party that is struggling to find its way after losing the presidential race and the Senate majority. These defections have been reported in just a few states, and it is believed that the wave could be bigger across the country. Many voters have been reportedly changing their affiliation in key swing states that were at the heart of the battle for the White House and the control of Congress. The trend has accelerated since the deadly attack on Capitol grounds and the impeachment of Trump for inciting the violence. Official data say that the U.S. economy contracted at its sharpest in 2020 with the COVID-19 pandemic, inflicting heavy losses in the country's labor market. The world's largest economy shrunk by 3.5% last year, its worst performance since World War II. The coronavirus pandemic has ravaged businesses in the U.S., throwing millions of Americans out of work. The U.S. Commerce Department says gross domestic product rose 1% in the final 3 months of 2020, marking a sharp slowdown from the previous quarter. This comes amid a resurgence of coronavirus infections and the exhaustion of nearly $3 trillion in relief money from the government. President Joe Biden has proposed a $1.9 trillion emergency relief package, although some lawmakers have balked at its cost. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. China warns Taiwan against moving toward declaration of formal autonomy, saying independence means war. China's defense ministry stressed that Taiwan is an inseparable part of the country, and those in Taiwan who, quote, play with fire will burn themselves. Tensions are running high between Beijing and Taipei, following a recent rise in China's military activities near Taiwan. Beijing said that its military activities in the region were a response to foreign interference in the region and provocations by Taiwanese forces. Beijing is critical of Washington's deepening ties with the self-ruled island, which China views as part of its territory. It has repeatedly called on the U.S. to abide by the One China policy and to stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Our correspondent Stephen Rive joins us from Beijing. We also have Bill Jones, Washington Bureau Chief at the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Washington, D.C. Very well. Let me start with you, Stephen Rive. Tell us about the warning that China has leveled against Taiwan.
Well, China has warned that a declaration of independence by Taiwan would mean war in the past. I think what it really wants to know now is Joe Biden's policy and whether he's going to continue in the same direction that Trump was in, or whether he's going to back down and back off and adopt a position which is more to China's liking. To explain, before Trump, America's presidents put pressure on Taiwan not to declare independence formally. You see, the foundation of U.S.-China relations are three accords dating back to the presidencies of Nixon and Carter, central to which are agreement on the principle that there is only one China. And although America is committed to the defense of Taiwan, or rather supplying Taiwan with a means to defend itself, it has always been a moderating influence and applied pressure on Taiwan not to move in a position which Beijing has clearly indicated would mean war. Now, after Trump came in, he adopted a more hawkish policy. He called President Tsai Ing-wen, she's the independent-minded leader of the Kuomintang, who, after she was elected, which was a violation of the one-child policy, you might say, because he was essentially recognizing her as the leader of Taiwan and not saying Taiwan was part of China. He oversaw the visit of a cabinet member to Taiwan. He authorized the first sale of fighter jets for three decades. And it really did look like he was moving away from this one China principle, which is part of the foundations, or has been in the foundations of U.S.-China relations. That prompted China to take a more hawkish position, because as it saw it, Trump was encouraging Tsai Ing-wen to make independent-like utterances. So China started stepping up these military exercises, and the whole relation over Taiwan became more and more tense. I think the indications are that Biden will back off slightly from Trump's collision course with China, as China will call it, China would say that Trump was heading towards disaster. I think Biden, he's reaffirmed the existing agreements with China, and he's made kind of quite moderating utterances. For example, he's urged Beijing to engage in meaningful dialogue with Taiwan's democratically elected representatives. That's different from Trump's Secretary Pompeo, who was really calling for a giant strengthening of ties with Taiwan. So I think what China would really like to see now is a clear indication by Joe Biden that he's not continuing on the same course as Trump. And I think that's what China's going to get. As I said, this talk of war, if China calls or declares independence, is nothing new, although it is, shall we say, quite a harsh position that China's taken in recent years. But it has said before that a declaration of independence by Taiwan would mean war.
Uh-huh.
And so I think it would like to see America dump what it does with presidents prior to Trump, and that's put pressure on Taiwan to tone down independence rhetoric.
Bill Jones, do you think that that's what's going to happen based on what our correspondent said there, that Biden is going to take a softer approach on the issue?
Well, it's still up in the air. I think there are two reasons for China doing what it's doing now. One is a message to the United States. The other is a message to Taiwan, because the independent forces on Taiwan have been encouraged by the previous policy. They probably would like a little bit of more of the same from the Biden administration. There are certain signs that that he is kind of compromising that direction. He invited the representative of Taiwan to attend the inauguration, which was also noted by the press quite widely. But I think Taiwan is the most important core interest of China at this point. They will not allow any kind of change in the status of the island. And, of course, it has been the biggest bone of contention for the United States, because, remember, Taiwan exists solely because the United States was totally isolated from China and were supporting an alternative regime on the island of Taiwan. So it's an issue that that is of great concern for the Chinese, and I think it's also understood by the U.S. side that whatever differences we may have with China, any attempt to encourage an independent stance on Taiwan would probably lead to a military conflict, and I think that's what they want to avoid. So I think, in reply to your question, I think Biden will probably be a lot more cautious with regard to this thing, although I do think we will see some tensions with regard to Taiwan, with regard to China. But I think there'll be certain tones where there will be collaboration, which was really not existent at the end of the Trump administration.
Well, Bill Jones, quickly, if you can, the pivot to China started with the Obama administration, and of course it picked up steam with Trump. Do you think that therefore there's going to be some rollbacks here? Or does the whole China thing, because there's a whole host of issues that the U.S. has to deal with when it comes to China, that one actually affects the other?
Well, they're certainly going to continue with the so-called Indo-Pacific policy of trying to bring together the allies in a containment of China. The question is really, can they do it? Are the allies really prepared to take a tougher line against China, which now has become the real engine of economic growth in the world during this post-COVID period? And I think there's also an understanding that the United States' capabilities are dependent on their own scientific and technological potentials. Those are decreasing with time. And I think what Biden is doing in a lot of the green policy that he's initiating, he's going to undercut some of the potential for the United States to move technologically to actually remain a major scientific power. And we see from what China is doing now with its new five-year program is they're going to move forward very, very quickly. And if the United States does not get in step with that and insist on this Indo-Pacific policy, it could really lead to war. And that's the big danger. But I don't think the other countries are going to get on board that. and I think they will be very friendly to the United States. They will be very polite in talking with them on this issue. But if push comes to shove, and they have to push a tougher line against China because of the United States, I don't think they're going to do it. And I think that's all along the line. Japan, South Korea, all of these countries are not going to endanger their own national interest for an ideological thrust of China containment.
Thank you very much for that, Bill Jones. Washington Bureau Chief, Executive Intelligence Review. Thank you, Stephen Rebe, correspondent from Beijing. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. The World Health Organization says COVID-19 transmission rates in Europe remain too high, warning that it is too early to ease up restrictions.
Transmission rates across Europe are still very high, impacting health systems and straining services, making it too early to ease up. Pushing transmission down requires a sustained, consistent effort.
Hans Kluge said that 3% of the people in Europe have had a confirmed COVID-19 infection. He said that emerging variants of the virus make it urgent to vaccinate priority groups. However, he noted that the rate of vaccine production and distribution was not yet meeting expectations. 2 days from now will mark a year since WHO declared the novel coronavirus a public health emergency, the organization's highest level of alarm. COVID-19 cases in Europe are nearing 30 million, while the total death toll is reaching 600,000. This makes Europe the worst-hit continent by the pandemic after North America. Syrian and Russian military officials have held a joint press conference to shed further light on the current military condition in Syria, as well as joint action made by the two sides over the past year to end the Syrian crisis. Mohammed Ali has more from Damascus.
The second joint Syrian-Russian press conference was held in Syria's capital, Damascus. Head of the Syrian Army's political administration reiterated the Syrian Army's determination to secure every inch of Syria. He said Turkey continues to violate Idlib deals and Syria's sovereignty.
Turkish forces continue to deploy more military reinforcements and set up new observation posts in violation of Syrian sovereignty and the Sochi deal signed in Russia in 2018. As a result of Turkey's violations, Idlib has turned into a hub for terrorist organizations that are supported by the Turkish regime.
Meanwhile, Deputy Chief of Russia's Reconciliation Center in Syria said Russia estimated the number of terrorists in Idlib at 19,000. Almost half of them supported by Turkey. Meanwhile, he pointed out that Syrian Kurds have been escalating tension east of the Euphrates River.
Back in January, we found out that precisely the situation had become more complicated in Ain Issa area. The Kurdish side was deliberately escalating tensions there. We believe that the U.S. was supervising the Kurds' operations to undermine Russia's efforts prior to the meeting between the foreign ministers of Russia and Turkey.
Syria's Minister of Local Administration said the government's efforts are underway at the highest level to create suitable circumstances for refugees' return.
This month only thousands of refugees returned from Lebanon and Jordan. Tens of thousands of internally displaced Syrians continue to go back to their homes. The government is working hard to bring back the displaced people to Yarmouk refugee camp in parallel with restoring the infrastructure in Damascus and Idlib countryside.
Makhlouf explained that this month 26 industrial facilities have restarted functioning, while 1,522 job opportunities have been created, noting that the bulk of investment reached 14.5 billion Syrian pounds.
Officials and military personnel from Syria and Russia gave a briefing on their recent efforts made this year for restoring security back to Syrian territories and paving the way for refugees' return. Holding this conference represents a message of determination from Syria and Russia that their joint action will eventually lead to a strong and prosperous Syria. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The European Union has threatened to block exports of coronavirus vaccines to countries outside the European bloc, countries such as Britain, after AstraZeneca was accused of failing to give a satisfactory explanation for a huge shortfall of promised doses to member states. The pharmaceutical company's new distribution plans were said to be unacceptable after it surprisingly informed the European Commission on Friday, 22nd of January, that there would be significant shortfalls on the original schedule. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Daniel Buffy. The piece is titled, European Union Threatens to Block COVID Vaccine Exports Amid AstraZeneca Shortfall. Stay with us for more of Daniel Buffy's article. The European Union has threatened to block exports of coronavirus vaccines to countries outside the European bloc, countries such as Britain, after AstraZeneca was accused of failing to give a satisfactory explanation for a huge shortfall of promised doses to European member states. The pharmaceutical company's new distribution plans were said to be unacceptable after it surprisingly informed the European Commission on Friday, 22nd of January, that there would be significant shortfalls on the original schedule. The European Union has been due to receive 100 million doses of the vaccine in the first quarter of this year, but it is feared that the bloc will only receive half of that despite making large advance purchases ahead of authorization of the vaccine by the European Medicines Agency. In a heated telephone conversation with AstraZeneca's chief executive, Pascal Sorio, on Monday, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the company must live up to its contractual obligations. The European Medicines Agency is expected to authorize the AstraZeneca vaccine by the end of this week. Ursula von der Leyen's spokesperson said she made it clear that she expects AstraZeneca to deliver on the contractual arrangements foreseen in the advance purchasing agreement. She reminded Pascal Sorio that the European Union has invested significant amounts in the company up front, precisely to ensure that production is ramped up even before the conditional market authorization is delivered by the European Medicines Agency. Of course, production issues can appear with the complex vaccine, but we expect the company to find solutions and to exploit all possible flexibilities to deliver swiftly. The European Union's Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, made a televised statement to express her frustration at the company's behavior, warning that the answers so far provided by AstraZeneca had not been satisfactory. debate on Monday evening, 25th of January, following discussions with executives representing the pharmaceutical company. The European Union's Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, tweeted, "Discussions with AstraZeneca today resulted in dissatisfaction with a lack of clarity and insufficient explanations from the company. European Union member states are united. Vaccine developers have societal and contractual responsibilities they need to uphold. With our member states, we have requested from AstraZeneca a detailed planning of vaccine deliveries and when distribution will take place to member states. Another meeting will be convened on Wednesday to discuss the matter further." The development has raised pressure on the Commission, just as it is being criticized for the slow rollout of vaccination programs in European Union member states in comparison with the United Kingdom and the United States. The United Kingdom has administered more than 10 doses per 100 residents, but according to data gathered by Airfinity, a London-based life sciences analytics company, the European Union has administered just under 2 doses per 100 residents. The EU Health Commissioner Stella Kyriakides said Brussels would now insist on being notified of any exports of vaccines from EU sites, including that produced by Pfizer, on which the United Kingdom is reliant on European laboratories for supplies, raising the specter of an export ban. Kyriakides said, "You know that AstraZeneca vaccine is currently in the final stages of approval with the European Medicines Agency. If all requirements are met, the European Medicines Agency could recommend market authorization by the end of this week. But there is a problem in the supply side. Last Friday, the company, AstraZeneca, surprisingly informed the European Commission and the European Union member states that it intends to supply considerably fewer doses of the vaccine in the coming weeks than agreed and announced. This new schedule is not acceptable to the European Union. That is why I wrote a letter to the company at the weekend in which I asked important and serious questions. The European Union has pre-financed the development of the vaccine and its production and wants to see the return." The EU Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, said the European Union wanted to know exactly which doses have been produced, where by AstraZeneca so far, and if or to whom they have been delivered. These questions were also discussed today in the Joint Steering Board of the Commission and the 27 member states with AstraZeneca, she said. "The answers of the company have not been satisfactory so far. That's why a second meeting is scheduled for tonight. The European Union wants the order and pre-financed doses to be delivered as soon as possible, and we want our contract to be fully fulfilled." The European Union has spent 2.7 billion euros on the rapid development and production of coronavirus vaccines. The European Union's Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, said the Commission had proposed that the member states agreed on an export transparency mechanism be put in place as soon as possible. Meanwhile, Germany's Health Minister, Jens Spahn, gave Berlin's backing to the Commission proposal. "We, as the European Union, must be able to know whether and what vaccines are being exported from the European Union," he said. "Only that way can we understand whether our European Union contracts with the producers are being served fairly. An obligation to get approval for vaccine exports on the European Union level makes sense." AstraZeneca said in a statement that the company's chief executive, in his conversation with Ursula von der Leyen, had stressed the importance of working in partnership and how AstraZeneca is doing everything it can to bring its vaccine to millions of Europeans as soon as possible.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
You cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came in, conquered, and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close too, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
This is not fair. So remember where you come from. Wait. It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
3 a.m. and the killing is going on. Imagine the United States paying for all this.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light, and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events. And I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
And what are some of those angles, if you could briefly mention?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given, at the very least, cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. it is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to maneuver, room for negotiation.
It is refreshing to see.
Yeah, very much so.
Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think viewers would find extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, oh, it's there's violence on both sides, I was shot at once, I was shot at in my car with a machine gun, and then he's asked later on, why do you live with your children in this dangerous area? He said, oh, it only happened to once. Mm. But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not necessarily being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, when I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this. And so began the Intifada.
But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years, so you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually, for a long time, the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent, and all that comes through in the course of the film.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in the documentary, you also see lots of statistics. It's filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and they quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000, so that the actually the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal one, an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground, it is talking to people you know, who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have some.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life, and you know, to see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the roads. I don't talk about the lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Hayadu Waglit, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you following from that clip of that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yes, well, that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue, because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different with all of its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, mm-hmm. which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident that it's apartheid in Israel.
Mm. And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of you know, all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly make statements, pass resolutions in Parliament saying, we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society, which has to adopt boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. You'll see there are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behaving in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films, because this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director, probably wasn't quite as veteran when he first started shooting all this and than when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the US government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world. And the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel Lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel Lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so. And if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how these Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yes.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's, as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is, who's to be master, that's all. Mm-hmm. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story and we have failed and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.